Let me congratulate Graham and Ivan for putting this together. It's a great initiative. And also, you know, for you to come out and present, you know, particularly if you're a younger scholar, it takes a bit of courage to do this, to expose yourself in terms of presenting in such a hopefully still friendly environment that we have here. So I think it's you know, there's so many benefits. You know, maybe we address some of them later in the roundtable, doing these kind of things of networking amongst Europeanists out here on the West Coast in particular. And, you know, I can only encourage you. You don't really know what comes out of these meetings. You say, all right, I just present, get some comments. But often, you know, these linkages that, you know, the networks that you build can be very influential intellectually for you in the long term. Social context, you know, you work with other people. So I can only encourage you to take up these opportunities as they come along. And maybe misusing my time up here, I can also invite you to participate in what Emmy Vadon and I have, you know, are part of a broader attempt to instigate this kind of network, of exchange. It's called Transatlantic Dialogue, which looks at, you know, Europe in Canada and tries to shed light on the expertise that we have here in Canada and address issues of concerns to a Canadian and European public. So if you look this up, you know, you will see it comes out of Ottawa, but Uvic is a major player in this respect. So if you feel, you know, to be involved in this, you know, you're more than welcome. Just another network for the lonely Europeanist out here on the West Coast. But, you know, my task is to comment on this panel, and let me congratulate you. The degree of coherence I found in this panel is rather not unique, but you don't find them too often at some of the academic conferences you go to. You know, you really have three papers that, from a legal perspective, address something that I consider to be at the core of current research on the European Union, which is the interaction between the EU policy formation, legislation, and domestic politics, social development, and to understand what the role of the European Union is in this respect. It's sometimes hard for us to explain this to a North American audience because they think, oh, there's an international organization out there that somehow has an influence, but they don't realize that we really have a new form of multi-level governance in the European Union emerging, which in its very nature is not quite comparable to what we have around, you know, on the rest of the world. Really, it's a genuine form of new governance that is emerging that, you know, we need to understand in terms of the interaction between the EU level of governments and domestic politics and governments and policy formation. So in a way, from a legal perspective, you know, your three papers contribute to this kind of discussion. And coming to the three papers, let me say, you know, I'm not a legal scholar, so, you know, some of my comments sound naive, you know, forgive me, and that maybe you can help me to understand, so that, or maybe my comments will take a more political science, social scientific perspective. I send us the paper first. You know, you give a wonderful account of the evolution of human rights conditionality in the European Union, going basically through the treaty reforms and showing how this has taken center stage in what the European Union tries to achieve and how it attaches other policy areas to the demand for the respect of human rights and minority rights. And I'm not sure, you know, maybe you can help me there. Your key question seems to be, why was the European Union so successful as compared to the OECD, to the Council of Europe, you know, that didn't, you know, have the same leverage, you know, they didn't have the same leverage in countries to enforce compliance in this respect. In a way, you give your answer already in your title, right? You know, you say, you know, it is related to the enlargement process. And so in a way, it's not too surprising in the end to your reader to understand, oh, it's, you know, it is very much related to the process of, you know, conditionality or saying, you know, if you want to become part of this exclusive club, you better comply to these. And clearly, the influence the European Union has had in certain countries, Central Eastern Europe in particular, was closely linked to this very process of negotiating membership, right? Yeah, so this is, you know, if you're thinking about the stick and carrot that you signed there, this is clearly what we have seen evolve. But then, you know, what about, you know, once this stick and carrot are no longer there? And yeah, then it becomes quite interesting to see whether the European Union still commands the same kind of influence. Think about countries such as Ukraine, you know, with Derek Fraser here in the room, you can discuss this later, or Turkey, you know, where indeed the very promise of EU membership is vague, you know, if not realistic at the moment, right? There's no appetite for more enlargement at the moment. you know, maybe really with the exception of Croatia, maybe Serbia, you know, we see about this. But beyond this, I don't see anything on the agenda. And you can clearly see how this realization has changed the domestic debate and preferences of politicians who say, you know, why should we comply if there is no longer this promise of membership? So in a way, even, you know, that might be the ironic part of it, even within the European Union, once these countries become members, you know, maybe the European Union has still, you know, quite a bit of leverage, but you know, certain developments that we see, you know, you cite Austria, you know, certain aspects, you know, where indeed, you know, some of the basic human rights concerns, think about Bulgaria, you know, you can, and Hungary, you know, there are a couple of countries now with, you know, where these issues come up again, right? So in a way, the kind of conditionality was a very unique political and legal context for enforcing compliance. So you know, maybe, and then you know, it's not by accident. Then you know, when asked about your alternative ways and how the European Union can exercise this, you seemed quite vague, going beyond laws and creating institutions. You know, that's one of the things that you mentioned. But clearly, you can see how you're a bit lost here once you move out of this, you know, the enlargement process. But that's, maybe you can explain what you mean by this a bit more forcefully. Okay, so let's move on to Irina's paper. Right, you know, we didn't hear much about the German beer, but you know, we're decent to do it a bit later, so we cut short there. It's, you know, it's a fascinating idea to look at the legal process and the role in particular of the European Court of Justice. Maybe to start us off, you know, you said, you know, that might be my naive background as a political scientist and historian coming into this. You know, you try to explain proportionality a bit, right? Yeah, but, you know, in my understanding, it is something similar to the subsidiarity principle that regulates the power and the exercise of power of the European Union and what fields, maybe, you know, correct me if I'm wrong there, where indeed, you know, the EU needs to become active in terms of legal terms, what are the fields in which the European Court of Justice needs to protect the spirit, the legal spirit of the treaties? I thought that's, you know, the principle. Let me just ask you about this. You know, I just cite from your paper. If proportionality analysis serves courts to restrain legislators from limiting constitutional rights, this I didn't quite get. You know, the limitations of constitutional rights, maybe you can explain this in terms of an example. I wasn't quite sure what the link is in this respect. But really, if you want to publish this, you can go a little bit more into Article 5 of the treaty, right, you know, just to explain what proportionality is. But really, the core argument that you presented here is, not to blame professors, but, you know, to question, you know, the democratic legitimacy of the whole process. But you do this in two ways. One is, you know, the selection mechanism, right? Yeah, how are these judges selected? I'm just wondering here again, you know, my knowledge is limited. Do we have actually, are judges elected to the highest courts or constitutional courts in countries? You know, is it really a democratic process? Even the state they are appointed, right? Yeah, so I'm just wondering what kind of criteria you use to say, oh, look, in the European Court of Justice, you know, these judges, they are not elected, you know, but, you know, to my knowledge, this is not really something that is subject to majoritarian principle of electing judges. And then you have, you know, the other idea of your paper is to say what we end up with then is, how do you put this, the governed by judges, so that the professors, you know, they try to extend their authority not only to look after the integrity of laws, but really to guide the policy process. But this is a tendency that we have in national jurisdictions as well. Look into Canada, you know, the same kind of the courts in a way have extended their power in terms of judging on central policy in policy areas. So, you know, that's an important part, but I wasn't quite sure where you're going with the argument, right? Yeah, this would be one, the misinterpretation of the proper role of a judge. Yeah, that would be one way of violating democratic rights, you know, the division of power that, you know, what you just described. Or is it the composition of the courts and the process leading? You know, you have two elements of the questionable democratic quality of the process, let me put it like this. So maybe you can clarify which way you want to go there. Okay, last but not least, and I'm looking to... Oh, there are 10 minutes? Okay, right, yeah. Anya, I had the pleasure of being involved in your PhD, so that sounds very familiar, and I can assure you, it's a very sophisticated argument that Anya makes in a in a great way of bringing together interdisciplinary research traditions from law, social sciences, history, if you want. And it is, you know, quite fascinating to see, you know, that, you know, what Anya does interpreting the working time regulation of the European Union in terms of its political and social implications for gender relations, for the relationship between a particular country like Poland and the European Union. But maybe I can push you a little bit on what this particular case is a case of. Because in a way, you know, in the end, what do we take away from your example? And it's a fascinating story about the dual sense of flexibility, right? The good flexibility, you know, allowing women more flexibility in terms of part-time jobs, you know, combining family and work, and, you know, if you want, from a politically tainted perspective, the negative flexibility that, you know, in favor of the employer to exploit labor and have more unpaid additional time and so forth. Where does it come from? You know, your story about how it is being implemented in Poland and leads to, you know, how, you know, watering it down standards, right? You know, and that's, you know, by the way, you know, in the beginning I said, Alexander, you know, here you have your hypothesis quite clear right there. The reader is not too surprised. You know, that is somewhat of a surprise. You know, that's always good if you do this in your papers, right, to come up with something that's counterintuitive. You know, you would say, oh, the European Union sets standards for working time regulation, right? And then what we see is actually that it undermines the relatively high standards that we had in Poland, you know, if you want to call it this way. So, but what is it? Is it, you know, for example, a matter of the EU legislation in this field not being sensitive to gender issues? You know, is it the failure of the EU? You know, that is such, you know, a common denominator that, you know, that it can't really regulate this in a productive way. And, you know, another question. Is the European Union really the agent that we should look to when it comes to progressive development of this policy field? Or is it a matter of, and that's what we've seen in all three papers, in particular the first and the last one, is that, you know, this logic of implementing EU policies and legislation in national context, that we have to be very sensitive to the particularities, right? It is not a one-to-one implementation. You have a directive, you have law, legislative initiatives at the EU level. How they play out in the national context might surprise us, right? You know, they might create very different outcomes depending on culture, on policymakers. So is it a matter of Poland as, you know, its current political leadership? So maybe it is indeed a neoliberal environment in which these legislation comes, and thus it produces this kind of outcome. Or is it a matter of, you know, is Poland specific? You know, that's another question, right? You know, if we discussed, you know, the, you know, whether it's great, good, would be a good idea to compare Poland, but maybe it has to do with Poland's transition kind of character, right, as a former communist country. So I'm just wondering whether it is a matter, you know, is it a case of a particular national context, right, or is it a case of misguided EU legislation that we have in front of us here? So I'm just wondering, you know, where you see, you know, if you read your paper, right, and the core of the argument, right? Yeah, where do you want to go with this? So, but clearly you can see this last paper is very polished. It's ready for publication. So you have different papers in different stages of development, but that's, you know, also a great thing to do at a panel like this. All right, I'll leave it here, and I guess we have still have 20 minutes.
Good, thank you.